Yes. Yeah, thank you. John. I'll double check. Yes, we're on. Okay. Hi. February. It's February already. Tomorrow's Groundhog Day. What will the groundhog see? Yeah. No shadow. Then winter's over. Right. No. But let me give you a little bit of a warning. I have this winter figured out, since we haven't had one yet. Next Friday, a week from, and I'll tell you why. Because my wife went to New Zealand for 7 weeks to escape winter, and it's been 75 and sunny in New Zealand, and she's coming back a week from tomorrow. So I've been telling her, well, you haven't missed anything yet. So a week from Friday, let's let her get back so she's not stuck in Philadelphia or someplace. We'll let her get back. And then starting the end of next week, we are going to have winter. We are going to have 6 or 7 weeks of winter. We're going to blame it on Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog, but it's really my wife's fault. Winter is waiting for Laurie to return. And then it's going to be 15 below, and we're going to have feets and feets of snow and blizzards, and it's just going to be miserable. Just to pay her back for having spent 6 or 7 weeks enjoying warm, sunny weather, and to convince her never to go away again for that long. That's my motive in making it winter when she gets back. Pardon? It's been a long time. Yes, it has. Yeah. But okay. But that's right. She's been having a ball. She's been having fun. Learning a lot. All right, questions? Monday. Any other questions? Okay. Quick review. A relation obtains when one person in a setting pays attention to or participates in the activities of another, and relations are what it's all about in families and in society and in our development. It's easiest to look at the simplest unit of relation, which is a dyad, two people. When you get beyond that, it gets much more complicated. So if we can understand one dyad, at least then we have the beginnings of understanding the more complex systems that people get in. And we have a dyad whenever we're watching or participating in the activities of another person. There are three basic forms of dyads: observational, joint activity, and primary. And that's based on what the people are doing in the dyad. If one is observing the other or they're observing each other, it's an observational dyad. If they're engaged in an activity together, they may also observe each other, but if they're engaged in an activity together, that's more complex, so we call it by its higher function. We call it a joint activity dyad. And if you engage in joint activities with people over time, you're likely to develop an attachment or interest in them, concern about them, and the dyad becomes one that you think about, the relation becomes one that you think about, even if you're not together, so it's important in your psychological space. And so we call that a primary dyad. Primary implying that it's important. Hey, these are the important ones, the ones that we pay attention to. You may be engaging in a dyad that is observing at times, joint activity at times, but if it is also primary, then we refer to the dyad by its highest level of complexity, and that would be its primariness. Question? Yep. No. Thank you for the question. I'll elaborate on that. I'm going to talk more about transactions and relationships a bit later today, but let me clarify that. We are taking, and Bronfenbrenner takes, a transactional view of relations. And that's kind of like being a constructivist. It's an important approach to understanding relationships. And it's a set of assumptions about relationships. And what I've tried to do in the book is define transaction in a way that distinguishes it from an interaction. And the defining characteristic, as I spelled out in the book, we have actions. Now, we do things. We have reactions that are in response to something that happens. We have interactions which go on between two people. And that's a more general term. And we tend to, although usage on interaction and transaction is fairly loose, but I'm going to be drawing your attention to the fact that the important interactions that we have, exchanges with people, are the ones that in fact do change us in some way, and we refer to those as transactions. Something has passed between us, which is what the trance means. Something has taken place between us, and the important transactions are the ones that somehow change us. So I'm going to use them reasonably specifically, but I will slip, as we all do, and talk about interactions between people when I really am referring to the important ones, which are transactions. And I just want to call your attention to not using those terms interchangeably all the time. But technically, an interaction is something that happens when two people are, for example, talking to each other or asking questions. But a transaction has the implication that the people are changed. There is something that goes on. One of them ends up with money, in the case of the example in the book. You go into the store. Did I use that example in the book? Yeah. So you go into the store and you buy something. You leave your money, you take the good. You have actually been changed by that, and therefore technically it's a transaction. And we even call it a transaction in the store. Yeah. Right? Your cash register computer has a key on it for transaction. And you only use that when somebody has bought something or returned something. So something is passing back and forth to make it a transaction. The rest is just customer interaction. If you're gaining knowledge, you could call it a transaction. I mean, the clerk who's responding to the person who comes into the store and asks for a yellow jumpsuit with purple polka dots on it, her view of the world has changed because she realizes there actually is somebody who would actually ask for that and would buy it. In the transaction example, you buy it, right? A yellow jumpsuit with purple polka dots. I don't know where you'd wear it, but Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey, maybe. But the exchange of information is one of those gray areas where if it really is developmentally important, then it's probably based on more than just a question and answer. So, but that definitional boundary between interaction and transaction is another one of the big gray areas. So it's probably best not to split hairs and try to figure out when something is an interaction and when it's a transaction. It's far better to take the next step in using the notion of transaction, and this is where I'm going with the notion of transaction, which is to think about relationships transactionally and to think about the fact that when you're thinking about a relationship, the relationship is not either person. The relationship is not even the sum of the two people. The relationship is the transaction, the exchange that goes on between them. So a transactional review of relationships says, I've got A, and I've got B, and then I have this other thing, which is the transaction between them. It's the relationship. And I cannot understand the relationship by understanding A. I cannot understand the relationship by understanding B. I can't even understand the relationship by understanding A and B. I have to study the transactions between them, because that is the relationship. Each of them has a view of the relationship. Their views are not the relationship. The relationship is a proximal process that involves the transactions between them. Okay. Now, let me make that a little bit more specific. And then I'll come back to where I was going to be. I was going to do this anyway. I was just going to do it a few minutes later. I can describe each person. I can talk about age, I can talk about the gender of this person, I can talk about the personality of this person. I can even talk about the way this person tends to engage in relationships. But no matter how deeply I understand that person and how complexly I understand that person, I do not yet understand the relationship. I can study B and I can understand gender, personality, temperament, age, history. I can even study the person's view of the relationship. What does he or she think of the relationship? How or she feel about the relationship? Even if I do that for both people, I don't understand the relationship. I'm not looking at the relationship. I'm looking at the two people. The relationship is an abstract third component. It is what goes on between the two people in the dyad. And that's called a transactional view of relationships. Because I understand that the relationship is what results from the activities of B in relationship to A and the activities of A in relationship to B. When they are having transactions with each other, they are creating a relationship. Now, it'll take you a week to wrap your mind around the difference between those two, and that's okay. You can wrestle with it. But it has some practical implications, very simple and very powerful practical implications. And one of those implications is that the relationship changes whenever either person changes. And as the relationship changes, it may affect the way the other person engages in the relationship. Okay. And we're going to come back to that. Another implication that's very important in understanding your own relationships using a transactional view is that many of us in our relationships don't apply a transactional view. We want the relationship to change. Okay, we're unhappy. We're frustrated. We're disgusted. We're, you know, whatever, dissatisfied with the relationship. And our approach to changing the relationship is to try to change the other person. Stop drinking. Do your homework. Love me more. Be more affectionate. Our thoughts about how to change the relationship are often focused on how to change the other person. You are creating the relationship as you try to change the other person. And as you try to change another person, you create change in the relationship, it's likely to be negative. If you're trying to get the other person to change his or her behavior. The transactional view says, I can't change the other person unless I change the relationship. And any change that I make in the relationship is because I change my behavior in it. The relationship is the result of my behavior and the other person's behavior in relation to me. The only thing I control is what I put into the relationship. The only thing I control is what I put into the relationship. If I want the relationship to change, I have to change my behavior in ways that will encourage change in the other person indirectly. By making it possible for the other person to change his or her input into the relationship. Now, therapeutically in relationships, that's absolutely crucial. Because what happens when people are unhappy in relationships is that they rarely come in to a counselor's office and say, I'm unhappy in my relationship. Help me figure out what I'm doing that is making this relationship unhappy. Occasionally, people do that. They come in taking responsibility and saying, help me figure out how to change what I do in the relationship. They're much more likely to come in and say, my husband's an idiot. Help me change him. Help me make him whatever it is. My husband's an alcoholic. Help me. What you end up doing in counseling is helping the person understand that they can't change the other person. You can only change yourself. And you can change yourself in ways that alter the relationship. And the other person might respond to those changes in ways that will make you happier with the relationship. They may not, but you don't control that. So, bringing it to another level of concreteness. Some of you have been involved with alcoholics in your life. Some of you have gone to Al-Anon meetings because you live with or are related to or try to relate to people who have alcohol and drug problems. Al-Anon takes a transactional view of alcoholism and relationships that are affected by alcohol. So when you go to an Al-Anon meeting and start complaining about your parent or your partner, you don't get any sympathy. You say, oh, well, okay, what are you doing that's helping the person be an alcoholic? And you resent that, typically, because they're blaming you for the other person's alcoholism, and they're not really. What they're doing is trying to explain to you that the other person has an illness. The other person has to deal with that. The other person is the one who drinks. The other person is the only one who can cut down on the drinking. You can't change that. Unless you can lock the person up and keep him or her away from alcohol. All you can change is what you do in the relationship. And some of you are familiar with the notion of enabling. What you discover in Al-Anon is that most of us who live with alcoholics or are related to alcoholics do a number of things that encourage and support the alcoholism that we think we don't want to have happen. And what you learn and practice is that when you stop enabling and supporting the alcoholic and the alcoholic's behavior, the relationship will change. And maybe the person will stop drinking so much, maybe not. But you give up control of that. It's not for you to control. You can't control it. You can only change what you put into the relationship. So that's a practical application of a transactional view of relationships. Another that often comes up is in a sexual relationship in a couple. The sexual behavior is a transaction between the two people, and people who are unhappy with their sex lives are often unhappy with what the other person is doing, and they're blaming the other person for that. Put blame into your sexual activity, and your sexual activity will get worse, I guarantee you. Blaming somebody is not the way to make them better lovers. You have to take responsibility for your own behavior and put into the relationship expression of your own desires, your own behavior in a way that encourages the other person to respond and relate the way you would like them to. But it always, in any kind of relationship, it starts with you. That's what you have control over. That's all you have control over. So when you take a transactional view of relationships, you change the way you think about relationships and you acknowledge that you have a view of yourself, you have a view of the other person, and you have a view of the relationship. Okay, three different concepts. And you have your own behavior. And that's all you have. Your own actions is all you can control. Your actions, if you change them, change the relationship. If you're smart about the way you change your actions, you may change the relationship in ways that will make it more satisfying for you and perhaps for the other person, but you can't control that. You may change the relationship in ways that make it better for you and find that the other person is unhappy. Then the other person gets to take responsibility for his or her actions. And if you're both working in the same direction, you can make the relationship better. But you can't change the other person's behavior. You can only change your own.
Can't some, like, a parent in marriage, sexual relationship, you know, be thought of as a developmental diet, and then someone?
I'm sorry. Okay, go back to the definition of a developmental dyad. It's one in which the activities are becoming more complex, the affect is becoming more positive, and there is greater reciprocity. So a relationship in which a major joint activity is sexual activity not going to deal with the implied pun there, where the activity is sexual, has the potential, as does any activity, any dyad in which the activity can become more complex. A sexual relationship can take place within the context of a developmental dyad. Okay, let me go back to the affect, power, and reciprocity and see if I can explain those, and then we'll come back to that. So hang on to your example and your question, and we'll see if we can sort it out. Okay, how are you going to understand the relationship? That's what Bronfenbrenner is after. How are relationships different? What are the important characteristics in relationships? We can describe people. We can describe their actions. But how do you define, how do you describe, how do you characterize a relationship? What are the important features of that? Bronfenbrenner went through a lot of the literature on relationships where people have tried to talk about relationships. And he went through it with his filter on that said, what characteristics of relationships are going to be important in people's development? If you're engaging in a relationship with your parent, with your partner, with your child, with your friend, with a teacher, you're engaging in a relationship, what are the characteristics of those relationships that are going to have impact on your development? And he boiled a lot of variables down to the three, the big three, I call them, of affect, power, and reciprocity. So, as part of the brainwashing, what I would like you to be able to do is anytime I ask you about a dyad or a relation, you automatically think of, okay, affect, power, reciprocity. RAP, if you want. Reciprocity, affect, power. Okay. Or April, if that's your favorite month. Activity, power, reciprocity. Or PAR, if you're a golfer. Power, affect, reciprocity. Those three should become so closely intertwined that whenever I say dyad or relation, you immediately come up with, okay, I have to talk about the affect, the power, and the reciprocity. As you do that, what are you going to talk about? Affect refers to the feelings, the emotional tone of the relationship. And affect refers to emotion. This is the noun affect, not the verb affect somebody. It's the noun that means emotion or feeling. And the affect of a relationship can be from very, very positive. Okay, what are some of the words we use when a relationship is, the affect is really positive? What do you say? Do you go clinical and say, oh, I feel really positive, really positive affect when I engage in this relationship? Nah, you probably say, I feel all warm and fuzzy. I feel cold and prickly. That's not positive. Cold and prickly is negative. Yeah, you learned that. You did the positive, the warm fuzzies and the cold pricklies in kindergarten, right? Yeah, that's part of learning affect. You say, I get absolutely giddy when I'm around you. I'm euphoric. I absolutely love this. There is nothing in the world I like better. Nothing in the world I like better. Okay. This is the most fun thing I've ever done in my entire life. That's positive affect. Or as my son invented a term when I'd been sailing for a few years and he'd managed to avoid getting out on the water with me. And the first time he went out, he watched and got interested in learning to run the boat. And he looked at me on a beautiful day on Lake Champlain with a wonderful steady wind and you know, just absolutely incredible. And he looked at me and he saw my typical expression on that kind of day on a sailboat. And my typical expression is, and he said, I got it. You have permagrin, like permafrost. It never goes away. Permagrin. I grin a lot. And then there's the negative stuff. Frown. Cry. Hurt. Hate. Resent. You've got a vocabulary. Somebody counted once in the Oxford Dictionary, there's something like 7,000 words that refer to degrees of affect, positive, negative, neutral. You know, we have lots of adjectives for describing our emotional state. So affect in a relationship can run the gamut along this dimension from very, very negative, hateful, you make me sick affect, to you make my day affect. And somewhere in the middle, there's some kind of neutral. Yeah. It's okay being around you, you know, but I don't grin and I don't frown and it kind of doesn't really matter much whether I'm around you. That's neutral. You're okay. Yeah, that's fine. No pain. That's neutral. Okay? Any relationship can be characterized along this dimension. If you look at how the two people feel when they're engaging in the transactions of the relationship. And it can be very, very positive. It can be a little bit positive, it can be neutral, it can be a little bit negative, it can be a lot negative. That's familiar, right? You have people you absolutely love to be around, people who make you really, really happy, and you have people who make you anxious, and you don't want to be around them. And it's fascinating to me that often in relationships, and we'll talk about this more next month, but often people in relationships say, I really, really love him, but he makes me very unhappy. How do you wrap yourself around really, really loving and being attached to and not wanting to be away from somebody who makes you anxious and unhappy? And that's kind of twisted. But maybe there's a difference between attachment and obligation and caring about somebody and the affect in the relationship. Some of you have relationships with your parents whom you dearly love that you would characterize as fairly negative. Okay. So let's try to wrap our minds around that as we go along. Okay. Affect shouldn't be much of a problem, as long as you remember that affect can be positive and or negative. It's still affect. You can have very strong affect that is positive. You can have very strong affect that is negative. So when you're describing a relationship and describing the affect in it, you have to characterize the positiveness or negativeness or neutralness of it. It's not enough to say there's a lot of affect in the relationship, because then I won't know whether you're talking about negative affect or positive affect. A lot of it could be bad, a lot of it could be good. It just depends on whether you're talking about negative or positive. Power in a relationship. Power in relationships has a long history of theoretical and research study. And it essentially refers to what you can put into the relationship in the way of influence. A relationship can be characterized as having balanced power, where two people are relatively equal in power. Siblings, perhaps, if they're about the same age. A couple may have very balanced power. They share the power well. Or it may be imbalanced. One person may have much more power than the other. In a parent-child relationship, it's fairly easy to suggest that the parent typically has much more power than the child. It's arguable. It's arguable. Because kids have their own kind of power to influence adults. You know, holding your breath and turning blue is one of those. You know, kids do that. Parents get all funny. But overall, parents probably have more power to influence the relationship than children do. Okay. To influence the behavior of the other person. It's probably easier to think about that when you're looking at a relationship between partners, for example. Is one of them submissive? Doesn't put much influence, does what the other person says he or she should do, is controlled by the other person, doesn't understand what's going on in the relationship. You've been in those, right? Some of you are very good at running relationships, telling the other person what to do, making it an unhappy relationship if you choose to do that on a particular day. You have power in the relationship. Teachers have a lot of power in a classroom. We determine what goes on in the classroom. We make the decisions. We tell people where to sit, alphabetically or by number or height or whatever. We tell them what to study. We tell them what to turn in. We grade it. We flunk them. We determine whether they go on to the third grade. A lot of power in that dyadic relationship between teacher and child. Okay? Power, kind of intuitively, okay. It can be balanced or imbalanced. And if it's imbalanced or unbalanced, then you get to specify which person in the relationship has the greater power. Third characteristic, reciprocity. Reciprocity refers to the characteristic of the transactions that are taking place and primarily refers to who is initiating them. And reciprocity can be high or low. Now this gets confusing, because when there is low reciprocity, it means that one person is initiating the activities, determining what's going to happen, and the other person is not doing that. So, for example, low reciprocity would characterize the dyadic relationships that I have with most of you. You come to class, I talk. You take notes, I talk. You take more notes, I talk. You take notes. You even sometimes are taking notes about what I'm talking about. Okay. And only occasionally do I give you an opportunity to talk. Okay. And when I do, most of you don't. Some of you do. So there's actually very little reciprocity in here. The level of reciprocity is very low. If you come to my office one-on-one, we will have a very different kind of relationship. We will have a very different kind of transaction, and there is likely to be a high degree of reciprocity, which means you will initiate, I'll ask questions, you will ask questions, I'll make comments, I'll share stories, you'll share stories, you'll tell me about your life, I'll tell you about my life. We'll go back and forth. And there'll be much more. You have to test this to find out if it's really true. Can he really shut up and listen? That's a question about reciprocity. One-on-one, we're much more likely to have reciprocity, and I really will listen sometimes. And I really will tell long-winded stories. But I'll listen to your long-winded stories if you have them too, and I'll be quite interested in them. That relationship is characterized by a high level of reciprocity. We're both putting into it. We are reciprocating the roles, talking and listening. You may come in and have academic questions, and I may take notes while you're talking. Ooh. And you might take notes when I'm making suggestions. So we would be reciprocating those roles. We would be taking turns. The reciprocity has to do with taking turns, initiating activities and responding, being engaged in the relationship in ways that are, if the reciprocity is high, are relatively equal. Okay? So when you think about the relationship, the reciprocity in a relationship, and thinking about the give and take, the equality of that, the taking turns, switching roles, listening, talking, comforting, complaining. In a relationship that has high reciprocity, people tend to be doing roughly the same thing. And they're sharing the roles. They're both playing the same role. In a relationship with low reciprocity, they're not sharing the roles. I'm talking, you're listening and taking notes. I'm active, you're passive. I'm awake, you're asleep. No, you're not. I really like you, by the way, because you're not sleeping. You're actually paying attention and trying to make sense out of what I'm saying and asking really good questions. Julie and I have commented on this from the beginning. Great class this year. Wow. I like that. You just have to keep up the reciprocity. Ask questions. Increase them. Don't let me get away with talking for 75 minutes straight. I can. I will. I do. But when I give you an opportunity, I throw out a question. Okay? So these are three characteristics of all relationships. You ought to be able to look at any of the relationships that you're in relationship with your roommate, your girlfriend, your parent, your child, your niece, the kids you babysit for, anybody you have a relationship with, you should be able to go down the list and say, okay, what's the affect in this relationship? Who has the power? And is it balanced or imbalanced? And how much reciprocity is there in this relationship?
In the book, you said that these three things were fairly independent of each other, but if reciprocity is low, wouldn't that give one person more power in the relationship?
Yes. In the book, I do make the absurd and debatable claim that these three are relatively independent of each other. And what I really mean by that, and Julie's taking notes for the next revision, what I really mean by that is that conceptually they are separable, but they are clearly interrelated with each other because they affect each other. Okay. And a relationship has all three of them, and they are not in reality independent of each other. But they are not necessarily predictably related with each other. They're not dependent on each other, but they influence each other. I'm not sure I'm expressing that the way I think it, but that's close enough. But at least conceptually, you can have very imbalanced power and very positive affect. You can have very positive affect and a balance of power. Some people are only happy in a relationship where the power is imbalanced. And if you get the dominatrix and the submissive together, it's sort of defining the relationship between a sadist and a masochist. You know the definition of a sadist? A sadist is a person who makes a masochist happy. Think about it. Okay. There is no necessary relationship among these three, but they do tend to, in a particular relationship, influence each other. But what will happen, as Bronfenbrenner walks you through this, is that aspects of each go into making a dyad developmentally influencing. It will facilitate your development more if it is characterized by positive affect. It will facilitate your development more if the degree of reciprocity increases, so it becomes more equal. And it will influence your development more, or enhance it more, if the power becomes more equal. And Bronfenbrenner puts that very specifically in Hypothesis 4, when he says that the developmental impact of a dyad increases as the level of reciprocity goes up, as the mutuality of positive feeling goes up, and as the power shifts in favor of the developing person. Now, this hypothesis assumes that in many relationships there is an imbalance of power, the teacher and the child, for example, and there's not a high degree of reciprocity, and we hope there's positive affect. But what he argues is that as the affect becomes mutually positive, the teacher likes the kid likes the teacher, they enjoy their transactions together. That's mutual positive feeling. Okay, they smile when they see each other. That doesn't necessarily happen the first day. But as time goes along in this dyad, if the mutuality of positive affect increases, and as there is greater reciprocity. The kid has more input into the activities that he or she does. And the teacher encourages that. And as the teacher allows the child to exercise more power in the relationship, make more choices, determine what they're going to talk about, think about what he or she is going to write about, how to apply the material they're learning. Those are ways of giving the kid more power and increasing the reciprocity. The relationships in which that happens, in which those are the directions, those are the relationships that are going to influence your development. So the nature of the relationships that you have, particularly with people who are older, wiser, more developed, the relationship with those people can change. It doesn't have to, but it can change. And if it's a relationship that's going to enhance your development as the less developed person, then it's going to be a relationship that becomes more positive in the affect, more balanced in the power, and more reciprocal in the activities. A quick example, apply that to parenting. Let's assume that when you're born, your parents have all the power. They can drown you in the bucket if they want. Now, we have laws against it, but you can't really defend yourself as an infant, which is one way of defining power. You can look cute, and you can cuddle, and that's a kind of power, but only if your parents are responsive to that. As the child grows up, some parents like their kids and promote positive affect, and the kids like their parents. Yeah, so the affect continues to be positive, even through puberty. It's possible to have positive relationships with your parents even as you go into adolescence. Parents yield their power. Some parents don't yield it very easily, and some parents are eager to teach you the skills that you need to take care of yourself, to do the things that you need to do to contribute to your own well-being. They teach you the skills that you need. And they stop exercising power over you. And they gradually share the power. Those are parents who are enhancing your development. The parent who keeps the power and says, I'll make the decisions, I'll decide where you go to college, what you'll major in, where you live, what you'll wear, whether you have a cell phone or not, I will decide those things. I will choose your health insurance for you. I will tell you where to go on vacation. That parent is not sharing the power. The power is imbalanced, especially if you can't do anything about it. That parent is not enhancing your development. Parents who enhance development increase the reciprocity. There's more and more input from the child, more and more choice of activities by the child, more and more direction of household activities by the child as the child develops. And the parent encourages that. Okay, so there's more give and take. There's more turn-taking. Parents who enhance kids' development are the ones who are saying, okay, you play parent today. You figure out what we're going to have for dinner. And tell me what you want me to do in helping you prepare it. You're sharing the role. You're sharing the activities. You're engaging in joint activities. You're letting the kid try out being in your role. That kind of activity enhances the kid's development. And kids like that. They like it, so it increases the affect. In that way, they're related to each other, because you discover often that as kids are developing more skill and are being encouraged to use their skills and to be more engaged in relationship with their parents, they appreciate their parents more and they like them more. The parent who is keeping all the power and telling you what to do and not sharing the reciprocity, you tend not to like very much. Okay. The example's clear? The exercise next week gives you an opportunity to look at relationships that you're in and see if you can describe them using the notions of affect, power, and reciprocity. Okay. Now, we've got relations, and we already talked about activities. And think about putting those two together. If you're engaging in activities, the joint activities that you engage in with somebody can be seen in the context of the nature of the relationship. And part of what I was just saying is reflective of this hypothesis that the impact of joint activity, that is, its developmental impact and observational learning, will be enhanced if they take place in the context of a primary dyad with positive feeling. So if you're doing something with somebody you like, with whom you have an established relationship, you're likely to learn better. Think about how much you enjoyed practicing with the piano teacher that you hated and who made you feel anxious and miserable, or your ski coach, or your riding instructor, or your whatever. Most of us understand from experience that if you're going to teach, it helps to like the people you're teaching and to establish positive relationships with them instead of trying to scare the daylights out of them and make them anxious so they stop coming to class and hate the work and then they drop out. There is a strategy of using antagonism and threat and anxiety, but it's not a strategy that is designed to enhance everybody's learning. It's a strategy designed to weed out people who aren't really committed to learning. A quick example comes to mind. I took a German class in college. First day, it was the second semester German class, and I'd had one teacher. I think they fired her. She was the one with the New Jersey accent who used to throw erasers at us. Anyway, I walked in January to my second semester class, different teacher, and guy had an unfortunate resemblance to Hitler. Little mustache. And he started addressing the class in German and expecting us to respond articulately in German after one semester. Huh? And he read passages in German and asked questions in German and was really, really annoyed that people were not, they didn't know enough German to be in his class. That was Monday. And my good friend and I were both in the class, and we left, and he said, "Oh, I'm failing." And I said, "Well, I don't know. Let's see what happens Wednesday." Came to class Wednesday, and there were fewer students there, and he did the same thing. And I did the old Protestant ethic thing, Midwestern boy. The more you suffer, the more likely you are to get something. The pain will make the gain. So I decided I was going to stay with the class because he would make me learn German or kill me doing it. My best friend bailed. Came in Friday, and the instructor, so. And then he said in English, "That's more like it. Okay, now we're going to do the same thing that we were doing," but he was saying this in English, first time he'd spoken English at all. "And now we're going to do this in English. He says, I'm going to read a story, and I want you to try to answer in German, and I'll read it in German." And he took out a book, and we spent a great deal of the semester reading Grimm's fairy tales in German. Once upon a time. And you knew the stories, they were all familiar, it was easy to translate them and respond, and he was very encouraging and very warm and very friendly, really nice guy. But he had used his strategy to weed out the slackers. He figured anybody who was still there on Friday really wanted to learn German and was willing to work at it. It was a great class, wonderful class. I'm not sure what it would have been like if people hadn't bailed out. So there's a strategy. But I learned the German not because he was threatening. That was just the threshold. I had to get over the threshold and then I could be part of the class that he was very warm and wonderful with. Again, another characteristic of relationships and their relationship to learning, to activity. It helps if you have the positive feeling, and especially if you have some kind of long-term relationship going on, and the activities become more complex, and there's more reciprocity in them. So if one person is running the show and keeps running the show, you're less likely to learn as much as you would if you get to have some input into how the activities are done and what activities are done. And you want the balance of power gradually to shift to the person who is developing. Not that both people aren't developing, but Bronfenbrenner keeps focusing on the person who is less developed, or the person whose behavior we want to focus on, whose development we want to focus on. Okay. Now, I'm going to switch gears in a minute. So let me see if there are any questions at this point about the nature of the relationship. I'm going to move to what happens when you put more than two people in a situation. If we look at a dyad, person A and person B, and think about the dyad, the relationship in it. Is it positive? Is it balanced power? Is there a lot of reciprocity? Are there joint activities going on in it? Is it a developmental dyad? Okay, whatever the nature of the dyad is, it is not going to stand by itself. And Bronfenbrenner suggests that as we get into more complex situations, there may be a third person in the room. Aha. And if there's a third person in the room, we have a triad, things get much more complex. What happens when you develop a triad, and this is fun math. If you have two people, you have one dyad. If you add one person, you triple the number of dyads. When you put the third person in, you have that person's relationship with each of the other people. Putting the third person in will influence this relationship. The third person will influence the other relationship. You will not behave the same way in your relationship when there is a third person present. Yeah, that's kind of standard scientific assumption. That person has some kind of relationship, even if that person is only observing. The fact that there's another dyad, two more dyads being formed, will influence the original dyad you're interested in. So Bronfenbrenner says, when you're in a research setting, you have to take into account all of the dyads that are present and how they're influencing each other. If you don't, you don't understand the situation. The same thing applies in any setting, any situation you're in. It doesn't have to be a research setting. If you're looking at a parent-child relationship, for example, that relationship is going to be different when they're in my office and I'm observing them. It'll be different because I'm there. The child will be different, the mother will be different, their relationship will be different because I'm there. And I will not relate the same to Julie when the parent is in the room. The parent will influence my behavior and probably hers. So the presence of the third party influences the original dyad. And Bronfenbrenner says that's a second order effect. These two people are affecting each other directly. The presence of the third person is a second order or indirect effect because it's influencing the way they affect each other from outside the dyad. Now that influence can be positive or negative. And Bronfenbrenner suggests that if we want to look at dyads that might be developmental dyads, for example, parent-child relationships, the ability of a dyad to function to enhance your development is going to be influenced by the existence of other dyads. So, if we make this one the infant, not intentional. That was. How many of you like that? Okay. There's the masochist. And that makes me the... Okay. Not my fault. You have the dyad between an infant and the mother. You take a stereotypic situation. You assume that the mother is going to influence the infant's development, support that, and they're going to develop a good relationship. Right? And they will, hopefully. The ability of that dyad to support the infant's development is dependent on the dyad that each of them establishes with dad. So the ability of mothers to care for their infants is influenced by whether or not dad is maintaining a positive relationship with mom, whether he is establishing a positive relationship with the baby, and whether he is supportive of the dyad that mom and the baby are having. And there's lots of research that supports that. And there are lots of other examples. This is one that's appropriate for thinking about families. Because you may ask yourself, how could dad not be supportive? Well, actually, he could be quite unsupportive. And we often are, not intentionally sometimes, but we're often not as supportive as we could be, and sometimes we actively interfere with the mother-child dyad. It's because we don't know any better. If this relationship has been good between mom and dad, they've had a dyad, that dyad is being influenced by the infant. Uh-huh. And in the process of establishing a positive relationship with the mom, the infant mom dyad may interfere with the dad mom dyad. And in fact, I guarantee it will. I sometimes give a lecture called What Happens When Two Become Three? When parents have a baby? subtitled How to Destroy a Perfectly Good Relationship. Because you can. Babies destroy mom and dad's relationship if mom and dad are not very, very careful about supporting each other and maintaining their dyad. A baby is a very significant stress in a couple's relationship. And it does, decrease the satisfaction in that relationship by depriving you of sleep, money, energy, and concern for each other. The interesting thing is that as mom is establishing that relationship with the infant, she's ignoring dad. And dad is feeling left out. And what some of us do when we're feeling left out is get resentful. And when we get resentful, we sometimes don't know how to express that in appropriate and positive ways. How do you express resentment in an appropriate and positive way? You say, well, love, I'm feeling completely neglected and forgotten in this, but I understand that and it's perfectly fine, and I support your development of that relationship. Or some such. What happens often is that parents don't realize that their relationship, their dyad, is going to be interfered with by this one. It's also typical, and I do a lot of workshops on fathers and boys and men, and one of the experiences that men have is listening to their wives complain that they don't participate in childcare enough. And I hear that a great deal, that women really are annoyed. But the ecological question is the mother supporting and promoting the relationship between the father and the infant? And the answer to that often is no. The mother, in fact, is shutting dad out. She's not supporting that relationship. And because she's not supporting that relationship, she's often doing damage to the mother-father relationship. The literature on that's fun. Mothers serve as gatekeepers. They also serve as critics. And the reality is, in our culture, that most mothers have spent years rehearsing the mother role. They've been playing with dolls from the time they were young. They've been babysitting. They've been taking care of infants. They've been encouraged to that. And the average father has zilch. No practice in that role. Has never changed a diaper. Has never cleaned up, spit up. Doesn't know how to hold a baby because he's been discouraged from doing that. Actively discouraged in our culture. Average father. Not all of us. Some of us are good. So, he wants to be an active dad. So the first time he puts a diaper on, having done it for the very first time in his life, it's not quite on right. Usually not quite on right. Having done it 1,000 times before, what happens? Mom takes the baby and readjusts the diaper. The lesson is, you're incompetent. And often she will say something about his incompetence. The appropriate way to deal with that is to say, okay, you hold the baby until after it craps, and we'll see if the diaper is appropriate. But I'm not going to adjust it. We'll let you find that out on your own. I guarantee you, after one lap full of crap, he will be able to put that diaper on so that no crap will ever get out of it. Because the baby's legs will turn blue and fall off, but we'll go on from there.